From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, March 12, 2009. Thousands of lawyers and opposition party members take to Pakistan's streets today, defying a ban on protest. We'll hear about President Obama's pick to head the Food and Drug Administration. And Kids Behind Bars, we'll hear the first of a two-part series on juvenile incarceration in the United States. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Bernard Madoff, the man accused of masterminding a pyramid scheme that lost $65 million for thousands of investors, pled guilty to 11 charges in court today. The judge denied him bail, sending Madoff directly to prison. The 70-year-old now faces up to 150 years in jail. U.S. President Barack Obama has appointed Seattle Police Chief Gil Kerlikowske as National Drug Czar, the popular title for the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Medical marijuana advocates say the appointment will be a positive step towards the decriminalization of the drug in the U.S. Mark Taylor Canfield has more from Seattle.
Seattle hired Gil Kerlikowske as chief of police in the wake of the mass demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in 1999. Before that, he served as deputy director at the U.S. Department of Justice under the Clinton administration. Kerlikowske's appointment has received endorsements from the American Civil Liberties Union and the Green Cross Patient Co-op, a medical marijuana patient advocacy group based in Washington State. During his tenure as Seattle police chief, he made prosecution for personal use of marijuana the lowest law enforcement priority for the department. The Drug Policy Alliance, a national group dedicated to drug law reform, says they are cautiously optimistic about the appointment because Kerlikowske has taken an approach to drug enforcement that emphasizes public health and treatment over prosecution and imprisonment. This is Mark Taylor Canfield for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
Chile's Senate has elected a former Pinochet-era cabinet minister as its president. The vote made the senator the third highest-ranking member of the Chilean government. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garatón has more.
The new Senate president, Jovino Novoa, served for 3 years as a civilian undersecretary for government affairs during the Augusto Pinochet military dictatorship. Novoa is a right-wing conservative and takes office with the backing of a coalition of right-wing and independent senators. He will serve in the post until general elections are held next December. The election has prompted socialist senators to stress that Novoa was in Pinochet's cabinet when at least 39 people were killed and disappeared. Novoa was also instrumental in approving Pinochet's constitution in 1980. In his acceptance speech, Novoa said that he will work towards political diversity. Human rights organizations and unions today express outrage at the result of the election. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garratón in Santiago.
Yesterday, thousands in Northern Ireland protested violence by dissident Republican groups against British security personnel. That has been followed today by a shocking prospect. A bomb threat now looms over the province. In Dublin, Don Duncan has more.
Security forces in Northern Ireland are scouring the province today for a 300-pound bomb they believe may have been smuggled across the border from the Irish Republic by dissident terrorist groups. The Police Service of Northern Ireland issued a bomb warning after the shooting of a police constable by the Continuity IRA on Monday. Now police services on both sides of the border are cooperating to try and identify the source of the bomb and, more importantly, its intended destination. Northern Irish police intelligence officials have already voiced concerns that an attack is being planned to coincide with St. Patrick's Day celebrations next Tuesday. The last major bombing in Northern Ireland was by the Real IRA in the town of Omagh in 1998. Claiming 29 lives, it was the single worst atrocity in terms of loss of life over the whole 30 years of sectarian violence in the province. The atrocity ushered in the peace process, which still holds today, a fragile peace that could be further shaken if another bomb were to explode. For FSRN, this is Don Duncan in Dublin.
Activists are rallying behind a Canadian national formerly imprisoned by the Sudanese government. Abdusifian Abdurazak is a suspected terrorist and was arrested in Sudan in 2003, allegedly on the recommendation of the Canadian Intelligence Service. Abdurazak's lawyer says he was never charged with a crime and was tortured by prison officials. David Koch has more from Montreal.
Abu Sufyan Abdulrazak is currently out of jail and has been living at the Canadian embassy in Sudan since last April. But the Canadian government will not issue him travel documents to come home unless he has a plane ticket. The catch is that without any money, and because it is illegal under Canadian law for others to purchase the ticket for anyone on the UN terrorism watch list, Abdulrazak is stuck. But at a press conference today, supporters of Abdulrazak announced that in an act of civil disobedience, over 100 people from across Canada have collectively purchased him a plane ticket. They are demanding that the Canadian government issue him an emergency passport by April 3rd so that he can come home. Abdulrazak's lawyer, Yavar Hamid, claims that official Canadian documents released under the Privacy Act and the Canada Evidence Act suggest that the Sudanese authorities arrested him under the recommendations of Canada's intelligence agency. Hamid described this as, quote, outsourcing torture. For Free Speech Radio News in Montreal, this is David Koch.
And finally, the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President George W. Bush last December has been sentenced to 3 years in prison. The television reporter Muntazir Al-Zaidi pled not guilty to assault charges. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Protesters in Pakistan chanted, "Hooliganism is not acceptable," today during one of several cross-country protests against President Asif Zardari. Demonstrators, mostly lawyers and opposition party members, defied a government ban on street rallies. FSRN's Masroor Hussein is in Islamabad with more.
As many as 400 lawyers and political activists have been arrested, and the government has slapped a ban on public gatherings. Leaders and organizers have gone into hiding. Police are preparing to seal off Islamabad from the rest of the country to prevent long marches from entering the city over the weekend. Protesters plan to stage a sit-in in front of the Parliament House. FSRN spoke with the leader of the protest march, Ehtezaz Ehsan, who is himself in hiding.
The first stage of our long march, which started in Karachi and Quetta today, was successful. Although the long marches were stopped and a lot of them have been arrested, but that has encouraged people to move on. All those who wanted to stay home will now join the long march. Our morale has not gone down.
Many fear the long marches will face a bloody response from police if they try to enter Islamabad for a sit-in, and the government has warned of a possible terrorist attack during the protest march. Rashid Rahman is a Lahore-based journalist.
If this intervention does not succeed, I fear the present political system will be rolled up and then the GHQ will impose a new system of the army's choice. I believe this will be a great setback to democracy and all hopes that emerged after the February 18th elections last year, and they will be dashed.
India, Britain, and the United States are watching the confrontation anxiously as it sidelines Pakistan's war against Islamic militants. U.S. Special Envoy to Pakistan Richard Holbrooke called President Zardari Thursday and urged a peaceful settlement of the political crisis. He conveyed Washington's desire to see democracy flourish in Pakistan. So did British Foreign Secretary Rashid Rahman again.
Obviously, they are intervening because they think it will distract focus on the war against jihadist extremism, and their job in Afghanistan will become even more difficult because the situation in Afghanistan is linked to Pakistan to the extent that, if the situation in Pakistan does not allow focus on the struggle against the jihadists, it will directly impact the efforts in Afghanistan.
Lawyers and opposition parties say they are protesting to reinstate the former Chief Justice who was removed by former President Pervez Musharraf. But whatever change the protest entails, it will not bring respite to the common people of Pakistan who face growing inflation and insecurity. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
Also in Pakistan today, a U.S. aerial drone struck the country's tribal region. It's feared as many as 18 people died. U.S. attacks on Pakistan's tribal region continue despite objections from Islamabad. Meanwhile, Pakistani paramilitary soldiers say they've killed 18 militants in a neighboring tribal region today. It's believed that hundreds of Taliban militants have crossed over into Pakistan's tribal regions since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. President Obama has tapped former New York Health Commissioner Margaret Hamburg to head the Food and Drug Administration. Hamburg's background includes public health and drug research and working as lead scientist for a group examining the public safety threat from chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. As FDA head, Hamburg would not only steer a new course for the ailing agency, which has recently come under sharp criticism for its mismanagement during a recent salmonella outbreak, but she'll also have to navigate the delicate balance between pharmaceutical companies and consumer advocates. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Margaret Hamburg was a former assistant health secretary during the Clinton administration and ran the New York City Department of Health. She would now use that experience to run the FDA. Dr. Sidney Wolf is director of health research at Public Citizen. He says Hamburg's public health background makes her different from those in the past.
The other people who have been FDA commissioners have been, there's one pharmacist, most of the other ones have been physicians. The FDA is, in fact, an agency in the public health service, has jurisdiction over food, drugs, other kinds of things. So I think that this kind of background is very welcome for an FDA commissioner.
The FDA has more than 1,000 employees and a $2 billion budget, a figure many say is inadequate. In fact, the FDA has been underfunded for nearly two decades. That's according to a report from the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Scientist Ned Fader is with the watchdog group Project on Government Oversight.
There's a process of examining and approving new drugs and devices has become more complicated. And the other reason is imports. There's now a flood of food and drugs coming in from overseas, and those are very difficult to inspect and bring up to the standards. That will require not the kinds of budget increases that people generally talk about, but huge budget increases to deal with that problem.
In his new budget, President Obama has allotted more funding to reverse some of the shortfall of the Bush administration, but there is another internal problem that the new FDA commissioner will have to deal with. Again, Fader.
The FDA is constantly under pressure from manufacturers and members of Congress to approve drugs and devices quickly. And sometimes that pressure is improper, and scientists at the FDA complain about that. They complain that their managers have ordered, intimidated, and coerced them to modify their scientific reviews, conclusions, and recommendations. They are, of course, very unhappy about this and would like to see scientific merit determine whether new drugs and devices are approved.
In addition, transparency issues have always plagued the FDA. Again, Dr. Sidney Wolf with Public Citizen.
Too many of the inner workings of FDA are done in secret, and the public isn't allowed to realize that there is serious dissension within the agency.
Wolf says favor usually tilts towards the pharmaceutical industry, with some companies even funding FDA drug studies. Project on Government Oversight scientist Dr. Ned Fader says many wonder what a new FDA commissioner will bring.
Obama said in his first day of office, he said, "My administration is committed to creating an unprecedented level of openness in government." And the question is whether that wonderful principle, which he enunciated both before and after he was became president and has repeated several times since then, the question is whether that principle will be applied vigorously at the FDA.
The White House is expected to officially announce the nomination of Hamburg in the next couple of days. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
two senators are introducing a bill today that would greatly expand access to the radio airwaves. It would allow for the creation of hundreds of low-power FM stations on the radio dial. Supporters say this year the appetite is ripe for passage. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Gerardo Reyes is a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a group that fights labor and wage abuse of workers in Florida's fields. He's in D.C. lobbying for low-power FM radio.
We need this to have access to the information that we need to hear in the languages that we speak. In my community, there are like 15 different languages, and every season we have like different programmings in those languages, in Creole, Mam, Canjobal, Mixteco, Zapoteco, and Spanish. Spanish for many people is the second language where I live.
Reyes says the low power station created for the Immokalee community is important for two reasons: hurricanes and workplace abuse.
When any situation of abuse happens, it needs to have a space to be told in order to avoid it. When a situation of crisis happens, we need to be able to tell our story in the moment when it is happening. And we cannot depend on corporate media to take that responsibility because they are not going to know what's going on in the community.
The 100-watt radio stations have a broadcast range of 3.5 miles. It's what people call hyper-local media.
Every community should have access to that type of communication.
Casey Ray Hunter is with the Future of Music Coalition. He says low-power FM has another impact. It will diversify the music scene.
A lot of places in this country used to be really known for their regional musical flavor, and that's kind of gone away in the last couple decades, and this could be one way to sort of get some of that culture back in circulation.
In 2000, Congress issued strict limits for low-power FM stations, saying their broadcasts would bleed into the broadcasts of full-power stations. Congress limited what's called the third adjacency. Corey Fisher-Hoffman with the low-power FM advocacy group Prometheus Radio Project explains.
So if there was a full-power station at 101.1, there couldn't be a low-power station currently at 101.3. There can't be a station at 101.5. There can't be a station at 101.7, the third adjacency. The next available spot would be 101.9. So this is really a battle over this very specific frequency, three places away on the dial from a full power station, which would open up the airwaves to potentially thousands of more low power FM stations across the country.
An independent study in 2003 found the concern of interference to be insubstantial. Supporters of the Local Community Radio Act are broad: Republicans, Democrats, Christian groups, civil liberties advocates, and first responders. Republican Senator John McCain is a co-sponsor of the Senate bill introduced today.
Prevail over the big broadcasters. It's really the small broadcasters and community organizations and groups against the NAB.
The NAB, or National Association of Broadcasters, represents a host of major commercial broadcasters like Clear Channel. They're a lobbying force on the Hill, contributing $1 million every two-year election cycle, according to the money and politics website OpenSecrets.com. In the past, the NAB has lobbied against low-power FM, looking to protect their full-power broadcasters. They have not returned requests for comment as of airtime. Advocates, though, think this year will be the year that favors low-power stations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
FSRN reported yesterday on the LA Times and why current and former Times reporters are suing the parent company and its CEO. The Times is one of hundreds of media outlets that have laid workers off. Altogether, more than 20,000 people in the journalism industry have lost work in the past 6 months. Journalism's economic crisis will affect new coverage, especially when it comes to diversity. Already, some 42% of newsrooms do not employ any journalists of color. That's according to the Boston Globe. And some ethnic media is downsizing and even closing down operations. So what does this mean about who gets to tell stories moving forward in this current crisis? Edwin Akongo is the former editor of mshale.com. That's a newspaper for African immigrants. He's now an associate editor at New American Media. He says that despite the fact that some ethnic media is cutting back, new operations are just coming up.
what you will see for sure in the next 5 years is that they are going to be stronger. You're going to have people more prepared to write quality news and to cover their communities in a more stronger way than they did before. And that's what we're involved in here. Is that we have fellowships for ethnic media that we're organizing here in California, but we can do better. And we have an advantage as people from ethnic communities that we have never relied on, I shouldn't even say relied, we've never had advertising from, like, you don't see Macy's advertising in our pages. So what we get comes from, what this little paper comes from mostly the community, you know. The community, and they know that, you know, ethnic people are very attached, for example, to their food. So I know that where to find the goat meat, and I go there, and it's most likely going to be owned by a Kenyan or a Nigerian or someone from the Middle East. So we shop there. So this is like a sort of the ethnic media model is a mom and pop supporting a mom and a pop. And I think as long as that continues, we're going to continue being strong.
Sort of the original citizen journalism?
Yes, yes. This is it. This is an example of it. Before it even went online, ethnic media had citizen journalism. And you have people who, whenever they see them in the mainstream media, it's either, you know, there's gunshots ringing in East Oakland or in Africa, there's an outbreak of this disease. And they're not saying that is not true. What they're saying is, listen, that's not the only thing going on in Africa. That's not the only thing going on in Mexico. And we bring this up and we report about when these things happen, but we also add the good things that are happening in us. And that was the original citizen journalism, is really people taking over telling their stories. And that's part of the reason that, you know, that I joined ethnic media. And one of the misconceptions about ethnic media is that people think they're full of people who don't know what they're doing. You know, people, great idea. I mean, you walk to our newsroom, you will never find a most diverse newsroom in this country, you know, at New America Media. We have highly qualified people, you know. These people make me feel like, wow. And I have a master's degree in journalism, and I still feel like, wow, you know, I'm the least experienced here. And what we are trying to do, like these LABs, the Digital Divide projects that we're doing, is to do this workshop. We're pairing up with the journalism schools across the country and trying to give them the tools that they need to go out there and tell a good story. And hopefully mainstream media will be more open-minded to pick the stories up rather than, you know, parachute people he knew don't know anything about the communities.
Edwin Okongo is an associate editor at New American Media, and they've created a new hive for hyperlocal news. You can find a link to it on our website, fsrn.org. Connecticut's Supreme Court recently ruled that imprisoning juveniles for life in prison without the possibility of release is not unconstitutional. The state currently holds 13 such offenders. The U.S. is one of a handful of nations in the world that carries out this sentence, and nationally, more than 2,200 inmates convicted of crimes they committed as juveniles have been sentenced to life without parole. But advocates for these young people take heart from the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2005 banning the execution of juveniles who've been sentenced to death. In the first of a two-part series on youth incarceration, Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
Anthony Allen was 17 when he was charged with killing 15-year-old Lorenzo Rowe in Hartford in 2005. He proclaimed his innocence and opted for a jury trial instead of taking a plea deal of 37 years. When he was convicted in the capital felony case, the judge had to impose a sentence of life without parole, since the crime involved the killing of a child under 16, and since execution was no longer an option.
I'm generally opposed to minimum mandatory sentences, and this was certainly one of those. But it doesn't mean no one deserves to be locked up forever.
That's Representative Mike Lawler, co-chair of the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee and often a proponent of criminal justice reform. But he says this issue is very complicated.
I'm a big advocate of making these decisions on a case-by-case basis. I'm not opposed on principle to locking a 15-year-old up for life under some circumstances.
The case Roper v. Simmons, banning execution of juveniles, was decided just 4 years ago. Alice Osedek, Anthony Allen's public defender, who took his appeal to the state Supreme Court, argued that imprisoning youth for life should also be considered cruel and unusual punishment, and therefore unconstitutional.
Based on the same neuroscience and reasoning of the Roper Court, where they've found that there are definitely psychosocial and neurological differences in those under 21, actually, that they shouldn't be held to the same punishment or the same standards as an adult.
But the court disagreed, specifically quoting language in the Roper decision that distinguished life in prison from execution. Ashley Nellis is a researcher with the Sentencing Project who just completed a national survey of youth incarcerated for life without parole.
Sort of an unfortunate consequence of two bad crime policies, one being the transfer of juveniles to the adult system, and then also the implementation of mandatory minimums, one of which is life without parole for certain crimes.
She said African-American youth are highly overrepresented in this population. She added that these youth are concentrated in states that use felony murder rules. This means they were not directly involved in the crime, but were present during the commission of a felony in which a homicide took place. In the waiting room of the state prison near New Haven, where Anthony Allen is incarcerated, are signs making clear that the Department of Correction considers people under 18 to not be fully independent human beings. One prohibits anyone under 18 from being searched without the permission of their parent or guardian. Another says that visitors under 18 must be accompanied by an adult who is responsible for supervising them. Yet when it comes to sentencing teenagers as young as 14 for serious crimes, they are considered adults. This reporter met one-on-one with Allen just as he was completing his fourth year of incarceration. Correction officials banned both photographing and audio taping of inmates, but he was free to talk about his case and his feelings about serving life without parole. He was soft-spoken, polite, and remarkably upbeat. He said, "I try to keep my hope and faith up. Someday I might make it home." He earned his high school equivalency diploma in jail and is now focused on his habeas corpus appeal, a procedural method to challenge his confinement. The likelihood of success seems remote, and he said if it is denied, I might not feel so calm and cool about it. Allen said he believes that imprisoning juveniles for life without parole is cruel and unusual punishment. "You can't strip a teenager of his life," he said. "You never know what his life might turn out to be." Connecticut is one of at least seven states that have appealed these sentences as unconstitutional and lost. So far, none of the cases has made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Public defender Alice Osedek says she hopes the state legislature will act.
The Connecticut Supreme Court said that they're bound by the decision in Roper versus Simmons, which didn't actually decide this. They only decided if the death penalty for youth was unconstitutional. But they also said it is our legislative decision, meaning that the legislators would have to change the law and ban this as a sentence.
A final hope is that one of the state challenges to incarcerating juveniles for life without parole will make it to the U.S. Supreme Court and a possible favorable ruling. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Thank you.